How's it, everyone? This is Nate. I get to welcome you to the podcast and tell you about our sponsor for today, which is Oakley Standard Issue. Oakley Standard Issue is a division of Oakley specifically for serving those that serve government, military, law enforcement, firefighters, and EMS, the whole lot. Qualified members are going to get exclusive access to new products, service-related discounts, that's the big one, but a whole lot more. Products they're probably already known for is the eyewear. Their eyewear is ballistic rated and industrial certified, perfect for on the job. Footwear that meets uniform regulations while on duty, which is kind of a big deal. Some of my favorite boots I've ever had are the Oakley boots that I picked up when I was in Fort Bliss doing a ton of ruck marches there. Other accessories like gloves and backpacks. Some of my favorite gloves I've ever had have also been Oakley gloves. Newly released off-duty styles and collections are definitely stuff that you want to head over and check out. Head on over to oakleysi.com to register. Then you can take advantage of our discount code, which is fieldcraft15 at checkout to receive an additional 15% off of your first order. Again, that is oakleysi, Sierra India.com. Built to protect. Make sure you head on over and check that out.
Hey guys, welcome to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. I'm going to be your host for this episode. My name is Kevin Estella. I'm the director of training here in the North Carolina office. And normally when I do an introduction, I feel like I've got to do a little bit of a backstory, but this one, I think I'm going to do a little bit something different. And I think you're going to get an idea right off the bat of what type of person or who I am interviewing just by this intro. And I'm going to do my damnedest not to sound too much like Bruce Buffer, but let's see what we can do here. So coming to the podcast, standing 5'8" tall, weighing 155 pounds, holding the rank of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, coming to the podcast with a UFC MMA record of 36 wins, 17 losses, the most victories out of anyone in UFC history, we have Jim A10 Miller. Dude, how was that? Was that pretty cheesy?
That was good. That was good.
You know, it's not what I do, but
it's always, like you got to get your horn dude a little bit, you know, when the introduction. So it's always a little cheesy in my mind, but that was good.
Well, you know, like I definitely could have done a little bit better if I had more caffeine in me this morning, but I'll tell you, man, it's been a rough couple days. And, you know, I swear to God, like I wish I had that announcer's voice because I would use it all the time. I would exploit the hell out of it. And, you know, I'd go to the coffee shop right next door and they'd be like, what do you want? And I'd be like, I would like, hey, you know? So dude, let's just talk. I mean, I think we should catch people up on how we met because I think it's kind of funny. You know, I was aware of what you were doing. I think you were aware of what I was doing because we both knew Montana Knife Company and we were in, I think it was the Denver airport and I had on, I forgot what I had on and I saw a Montana Knife Company patch on your pack and I was like, he's got to be going over to Josh too. And sure enough, you were. And then, you know, we met up over there for the grand opening of the shop. But kind of let's give the background of where you came from, how you got connected with Montana Knife, and then we'll jump into the UFC connection. So how did you get connected with Josh Smith?
I met Josh summer of 2020.
Okay.
I was out at the Total Archery Challenge in Utah that year, and he had just created their website. I don't think they had even had their launch for their first knife yet. And we ended up, talking for a little bit at the range. And, a couple days afterwards, he hit me up. He gave me a little discount on a knife, for their first launch. And I was like, hell yeah, you know, like I'm all about it. Cause I'd seen, Dudley, John Dudley at Knock On. He had one. I was in his booth with him hanging out and I was like, I really like that knife. So when he was launching them, I was like, yeah, I'm all over it, you know? So, I fell in love with what they were doing right away. Making everything sourcing everything in the United States and kind of doing things, in a way that I feel is right. So I started supporting them, you know, as much as I could initially. Josh and I became friends and yeah, he's a great dude. He's got an amazing family, and he's really created something pretty spectacular.
Yeah, we were sitting at that. I think we were sitting at that same table together at that time when he gave the speech. And I know that, you know, as he was talking to the group of people that came out to support him for the grand opening, I mean, he had his family right next to him. He was crying. Mm-hmm. And then he brought up all of his employees and he's like, look, I can't be in the spotlight alone. These are the people that make it. Like, he's a genuine dude. You know, I don't think people see that side of him too often. I mean, we're mm-hmm. very fortunate to see that. And he's a huge fan of the UFC. Like, last weekend, I was catching up with Bert Sorin. He was out in Utah, and he's like, oh, I'm going to the UFC tonight with Josh Smith. Josh Smith called up Dana White. I'm like, what? Mm-hmm. Like, and then you look to see who's sitting in that group ringside, and sure enough, Josh Smith is ringside with Dana White and, you know, Evan Hafer and you know, some of these big names like Bert Sorin. Yeah. So, I know he's a big fan, and the funny thing that I think the listeners would appreciate is the fact that, I don't know if you challenged Josh's son or if Josh's son challenged you, but you're like, I'm going to take you down. And that's been like a running thing. Like, can you, and I know Josh was like, why don't you take down my son? Why don't you drop him? You know?
That was Josh. That was Josh, trying to make me, not beat up his son.
Yeah.
But, you know, cause listen, Hank is like, he is a big kid. Like, He is a very big kid. Awesome. Absolutely, like, super respectful, like, genuine good kid. But, like, he's bigger than Josh. Yeah,
when I met him, I thought he was a junior in high school. And he's like, I'm 12. Yeah. I'm like, what?
Yeah. So Josh is like, listen, he's like, he's too big for me now. So you rough him up a little bit.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that kid is hilarious. When I met him, he was super polite, like you said, like a total gentleman. I don't know what they feed him out there other than like wild game meat, but man, that boy is big. And, you know, he's going to be an athlete. He already is an athlete, but my God. So something that I need to just like get out there, because people don't believe me when I said this. I told Glover about this recently. I was like, yeah, you know, Josh Smith has a bowling ball cannon. He goes, what? I'm like, I'm like, it's a bowling ball cannon, and it launched bowling balls over the mountain. And Mike was like, there's no way. I'm like, Mike, he told us that people are dropping off bowling balls because everyone knows that he has a bowling ball cannon. They're just like leaving bowling balls, and you go through a shop and there's like 15 extra bowling balls that are just meant for, you know, the cannon. But that thing, like, people don't believe me. So can you please verify that cannon will launch a freaking cannonball? How far do you think that was? Like, I could not estimate the distance.
I was having a tough time too with it, because it's it was a couple hundred yards, pushing, probably like 8 to the top of that hill.
Yeah,
that's what it looked like to me, at least, you know. And like, if he loads it with enough powder, he puts it over top of the ridge right behind its house, which is pretty gnarly. I mean, imagine you're in the woods and you're as the bowling ball comes screaming over your head. It pays to be the welder and blacksmith and knifesmith in the area, because then it's like, hey, I've got this bowling ball can, needs a little work, and who are we gonna give it to? We're going to give it to the guy who actually can fix it.
Yeah. When civilization ends, you need to have a blacksmith or a welder nearby, because they're going to be making the weapons that we're going to take to the Thunderdome. So let's jump into kind of like your fight life, because you've been in this a long, long time. And before the UFC, I mean, doing some quick nerding out, you know, some research on you, I know that you started very young and you have a background in traditional wrestling and then obviously jiu-jitsu. So can you kind of explain for the listener, like, how you got started in, you know, learning grappling, and then where you picked up striking and everything along the way?
I grew up in a wrestling family. I'm still here in New Jersey. I've been trying to get out. I'm going to be 40 and I've been trying to get out. So hopefully after I'm done fighting, I'll get out of New Jersey. But I will say that the county that I'm in New Jersey, the northwest corner, Sussex County here, is technically still part of Appalachia. So that should give me a little bit of street cred. But grew up in a wrestling family. You know, two of my uncles on my mom's side were very good wrestlers. I've got two older brothers, younger sister. So, as kids, my brothers and I were always playing, you know, football, baseball, wrestling. That's what we did every year. And as I got older, I'm the smallest out of the three boys. I've caught up, but by a decent amount, right? I was always the one kind of getting the tough end of the stick when we would mess around and play the physical games that we would play, right? I got into high school, and then I was like, you know what, I'm too tiny to do this, any of this other stuff, so I just focused on wrestling, I was a good high school wrestler, and I went on to I went to Virginia Tech for a little bit. I ended up walking onto the wrestling team my freshman year, a couple weeks later I was starting, and it was a great learning experience for the good and the bad. Mm-hmm. I basically had to work out constantly to make weight, so it definitely affected my academics.
What was your weight class?
I wrestled at 141 pounds, and I wrestled at 140s at my senior year in high school, and I was a late bloomer, so like I was still a 19 year old boy, like growing.
Yeah.
When I was wrestling in college, so I was like probably about like mid 150s and like super lean, because like before I started wrestling, the first couple weeks of college there, I mean, my friends and I, we were playing racquetball for hours, and you know, I mean, we were definitely always doing stuff, playing football and ultimate frisbee and all this stuff. So I was constantly doing stuff. So when I walked on and you know, the coach was like, hey, I need you to make 41s. It was actually the day I was going to tell him, yeah, you know what? I don't think I need to try to make 41s. So I had to kind of kill myself to make the weight. And I learned some valuable lessons, in that time. And I ended up, I went to school for engineering, and I went for engineering because I was always good in math, just naturally. And then I always enjoyed the sciences. So that's kind of where I got pushed to go into, you know, I wanted to go to school for like forestry or, you know, something cool that would have brought me like outside. I wasn't sure that that's what I wanted to do. So I took a little time off of school, and my brother Dan and I, we were working for my father, working construction, framing houses. And we had been watching all the UFC events and Pride, FC events and any MMA that we could watch, we were watching. So finally, it was, May of 2005. We decided to find a jiu-jitsu gym that had a MMA team, and the closest one to us was about 45 minutes away. So we walked in and trained. And of course we had been messing around, you know, like beating each other up every moment that we had downtime at work. And with our buddies, we would have like free for all grappling matches from the things that we thought we learned from watching the fights. You know, we went in, we had a great session, and we were both banged up. So it was probably like a week that we were out. And I'm sure our first coach was probably like, nope, we lost them. Those guys aren't coming back. And then 6 days later, we walked back into the gym, and then it was 6 days a week for like solid 2 years.
Before we get too far ahead, because I know where this is going, I could already tell like you're at the precipice of jumping to the next stage. So you're talking about you know, the college wrestling scene, the high school wrestling scene. And I think there are some listeners that maybe don't understand what goes into competing on a wrestling team where you wrestle off to determine who is going to show, you know, who's going to compete. And it's not like it's just given to you because you're the senior, you know, or you have the most time in. Like, it's a merit based activity where you send your best. So that to me was always compelling, you know, when I saw my friends in high school and they'd wrestle off. And I saw a lot of kids who, you know, they were seniors, but then there was the up and coming freshmen that just crushed people. And it was like, we got to send in our best. And I knew there were some guys who had egos that quit just because they got beaten by a kid that was 4 years younger. But it is what it is. I mean, that's the nature of the sport. But when you say you learned some of those lessons when you had to cut weight, it sounds like those lessons were painful ones, because I know my buddies who had to cut weight for various things. And, you know, my limited time competing in jiu-jitsu, I hated cutting weight. I freaking hated it, because I always felt like I was weaker and I would rather just go in not cutting weight and kind of, you know, roll the dice and see where they land. But what were some of those lessons that you say you learned with in regards to like cutting weight, making weight, and in that whole competition process?
Like the cutting weight part, like that's one of those, it's not even a necessary evil. Like it's there. I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it, I would like it if there was a way to get rid of it in fighting. You know, and it would take too much shuffling, I think, of weight classes and champions, and there's too much money getting pushed around that would, you know, kind of change hands.
Sure.
If we did anything that got rid of weight classes. But I learned, you know, what I'm capable of. I think the biggest takeaways, honestly, were, you know, from my experience at Virginia Tech was, you know, surrounding myself with coaches that are, you know, committed to my success and are interested in it. Cause that's one thing that I felt was not there. You know, like I walked on and had one of the better records of anyone on the team. And, I kind of got treated like garbage, because I guess the coaching staff felt that I made them look bad because they had spent a decent amount of money, gave, you know, a couple full rides to some other guys, and they kind of didn't perform as well as I did.
Yeah.
But then I also went from, you know, like I had a decent wrestling room as a high school kid. You know, there were some good guys around my weight, and I think that we all would have done better. There was a little bit too much ego, and they never really wanted to wrestle with me at practice. But then go into a room that had, you know, multiple state champs and just legit, you know, wrestlers. It made me a better wrestler. There were quite a few takeaways at this point, the whole weight cutting dehydration thing, I still dread it every time. I don't enjoy the process, I get the job done.
And you seem like the type of guy who's going to do it honestly, as opposed to the type, you know, they bring up their team, they hold the towel out, and then the guy's holding the front of the towel to take up some of the weight. You know what I mean? Like, it's such a show. It's like, I don't think you would ever be that guy, you know? I just know your character. But how did you make the jump from, you know, I won't say hobbyist, but non-professional fighter to pro? Like what's that process? Because I know that you can go and you can compete, you know, you pay like Naga, or you pay, you know, one of the grappling organizations, and you can work your way up to like Abu Dhabi's and things like that.
Yep.
How do you make the jump to pro MMA? Like, what was that process?
You know, back in 2005, there was not much of a process, especially in New Jersey. So it all depends on the state. So now in New Jersey, there's amateur, there's pro-am, and then there's pro. So unless you have a background and are successful in one of the arts that are associated with MMA, the, you know, jiu-jitsu, wrestling, sambo, judo, boxing, kickboxing, Muay Thai, and certain types of karate. You have to like earn your way, you know, and work your way up those ranks, and like get 3 wins at amateur. So then you can go into pro am with a little bit different rule set, different protective gear, and then you get a couple wins there, and then you can go up to professional. In 2005, there was nothing but professional in New Jersey. So the only other option that my brother and I had was that we could fight in the New York Underground, which was like, gymnasium basements. There was like headbutting and biting and all this other goofy stuff. And it was kind of a shit show. So it was like, hey, you know what? Like, we're going to do this. You know, my brother and I, we wanted to compete. And like, I'm not doing the silly stuff that really has no effect on my future. So it was right to professional. And it was, we walked in the gym that first day. We told our first coach, we're like, hey, we want to fight MMA. And he had a couple guys that were already fighting. And he's like, all right, give me like 2 or 3 years of solid, you know, consistent training, and we'll talk about it. It was 6 months to the day from when we walked in to, for our first training session to competing, you know, and fighting professionally.
Damn, that's wild. And yeah. How did you earn the nickname A-10?
I kind of, that was one of those ones where I kind of had to give myself a nickname.
No, you didn't give yourself a nickname, did you?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, man.
So, so the problem is when your name is Jim Miller, it's kind of just, it's like plain oatmeal, right?
Yeah,
Like it's just, it doesn't sell. Right.
You know what it is? So, it's have you seen the Key and Peele skit where it's like the East Coast, West Coast All-Star Draft? And, it's like Torque Noise. And then at the very end, they're like, Dan Smith, Brigham Young University.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, my brother, his nickname is the Beefalo. He never fought under it, but we always called him Beef. Because like Dan's always. He's always been a good eater. And if you know anything about a beefalo, it's a half buffalo, half cow. So they're big, they're hairy, but they're a little more docile than a buffalo. Like they actually respect barbed wire fence and stuff like that. So, so I was like, well, I'm short, hairy, smelly and ugly. So I'm like a warthog, I don't know if I wanted to be called the warthog, but my uncle, he was a retired colonel in the Marine Corps, and he was a pilot. And when we were kids, he would give us these calendars with military planes and stuff, and I always loved the A-10. And I kind of look at it and it's like, yeah, it's kind of built to take punishment, and dish it out. And it's not the most nimble plane in the sky, but you gotta respect it. And I was like, yeah, I kind of like that. So
yeah, there's something about the flying bathtub, that's what it's nicknamed.
Exactly.
Where like they built the plane around the gun.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like that's America right there.
Yeah. I kind of feel like I'm, I was born a fighter, I was born to do this. So, that's kind of, I picked it and it hurts. It hurts to say that.
It's okay. You could have picked something way, super vain.
There's a million pit bulls. or assassins in MMA. So
yeah, and how many Mandalorians and Spartans and what other catchy, cool guy do you think there'll be? Punishers. I got a funny feeling there's gonna be a whole bunch of Punishers out there.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the your fight history, because you know, that's so much of who you are. But then I also want to segue at some point into talking about you being an outdoorsman, because that's what we talked about a whole bunch out there. So, you know, there's any number of highlights that we could talk about, but I'm just going to pick out a handful that I was like, damn, that was impressive. So, Jesse Butler, 23 second win, like that was unbelievable. I mean, you caught him off guard. You hit him with, I think it was a left cross and then a left uppercut, and he was out cold. Was that the fastest knockout in your career?
Yes. Yeah. That's the fastest in my career. Yeah. You know, and that's just like, it's the way it goes. You know, here's this, my last three fights, I've had opponents fall out, within like 2 weeks, of the fight. And, you know, for me, the way that I've always kind of approached it, and I especially do nowadays, since like I'm definitely in the twilight of my career, is that like, I'm just looking for those opportunities. And if I can get to fight night and be, you know, relatively healthy, because there's no such thing as being 100% in our game. I want to fight, and I don't care against who. So, you know, Jesse hopped in on like 2 days' notice.
Damn.
Which is, it takes some stones, you know, on his part. But it's also like, he's got nothing to lose. So I knew I was going to be fighting a guy that was going to come after me as absolutely hard as he could, because, you know, to go out and to get beat by the guy that's got the most fights in the UFC history, you know, on 2 days' notice, is there's no downside to that. So, yeah, I just, I saw an opportunity and, you know, yeah, fortunately landed the shots, and unfortunately in the process broke my thumb, but
you know, okay. So I need to ask that question, because this is one that comes up all the time. I've broken my third, what is it? Metatarsal. I broke my third metatarsal teaching Filipino martial arts to a good friend of mine who elbowed it. And when I did it, everyone in the school was like, oh, like they heard it. It sounded like breaking a pencil. And people are like, oh, you know, I'm just going to punch that guy in the head. I'm going to punch him in the head. I'm like, how many times do you think you could punch someone before you break your hand? And then what is it like when you do break your hand? So I want to ask you, as a pro fighter, how many times do you think you could crack someone bare knuckle in the skull or in the face, the jaw, before you do damage to your hand?
I mean, this is the first time I've broken my hand or finger. Like and probably like I've probably broken my toe once or twice, my big toe, but, I've never like gotten an x-ray when it happens. so this is like the first time that I ever had to wear a cast. This is the first time that I ever like had a, an x-ray that showed I had a broken bone. So I'm not the best guy to ask that question.
Yeah.
Cause most of the time it's like, yeah, I punch him for 15 minutes and I'm usually okay.
Yeah.
It was just the angle at which I threw that uppercut. I ended up hitting the thumb in the right spot. And, you know, I felt it when it happened. But I think that I could have kept throwing the punches, but, you know, fortunately the fight was over at that point.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting is like, you look at guys when they go ground and pound, or they go transition from stand up to the ground, and there's a lot of hammer fists being thrown. And my jiu-jitsu instructor, Chris Smith, shout out to IMB CT, Chris Smith talks about how you can only punch the ground so hard with your knuckles. But if you were to have a temper tantrum, like make like the pounding fists, he's like, you can hit the ground a lot harder. And he always talks about that. And you see it in action when you see fighters do that.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the consequence of breaking your hand, it sucks. Like, was that your dominant hand, like the hand that you brush your teeth with?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, my left hand. Yeah.
So how weird is that, brushing teeth with your right hand, or wiping your ass with your right hand? Like, I know when I had a broken hand, I was like, this feels so strange. It feels like a weirdo's wiping my ass. You know, I hope they do a good job. So yeah, that fight was awesome. But then going through your other fights, Charles Oliveira, you got him with a knee bar.
Yep.
And you know, when people think jujitsu, a lot of people who are not necessarily trained, but they're aware of it, they only think like arm bar or they think chokes, and they forget that there's 50% of the body below the waist that's very vulnerable. So do you remember that setup of how you got into that knee bar? I mean, I'm sure you watched and analyzed the tapes a whole bunch.
Yeah, I do remember that one. You know, that fight, you know, that was, that was 2010. So like at that point, I'm 27 year old, you know, was in the UFC. I was on a pretty good streak at that point. I think I was like 7-1 in the UFC. And Charles had come in and I think he was like maybe 20 or 21 when we fought.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew at that point, you know, I will preface this saying that he got his revenge in 2018. I knew at that point that when we hit the ground, I was going to have a significant strength advantage. And, you know, he was very tricky with his jiu-jitsu back then. You know, he had a few submission wins under his belt. But I remember the lead up to that fight. I did a couple like fan expos and stuff like that, and like people were like, "Ah, oh, how are you going to deal with his jiu-jitsu? How are you going to deal with his jiu-jitsu?" And I was like, "I'm a black belt." I was like, "I'm a black belt and a fully grown man at this point." Yeah. Like, you know, I was like, and I think he was I think he had just recently got promoted to brown belt. And I was like, I'm going to show you, you know, like every time somebody said, I'll show you, I'm going to grab a hold of this kid and I'm just going to take something home. But yeah, no, I just remember that, like, you know, we were preparing to be the stronger athlete. And that's the thing. Jiu-jitsu is great. I love it. And there are definitely aspects of like the business of it that I know why they're there, like the whole technique matters, size and strength don't. But that's one of those things that's like it's built into the brand of jiu-jitsu, and it's not true because size and strength and athleticism are 100% important, you know. And there are plenty of guys that have shown this throughout the years that you know, in jiu-jitsu and in MMA in particular, that they have deficiencies in technical ability, but they make it work because of athleticism. And then there are guys who are not athletes that make it very far off of their technical ability. So like I knew that my technique was going to be good enough and my strength was going to be overwhelming for him at that point, you know, in his life, in his career. But yeah, no, I remember that one, and, you know, just swung on the knee bar and took it home, and I was pretty amped up for that one.
So let's talk about you know, your jiu-jitsu game, because take a break from talking about the particular fights. You know, when I first learned, I learned one technique at a time, and I'm a fundamentals guy. Like I love fundamentals with anything, whether it's long range shooting, pistol marksmanship, you know, teaching bushcraft, whatever it may be. I'm a fundamentals guy, and I'm like, if you can do fundamentals really well and solid, you're pretty strong. And then as you rank up, you start realizing that there are techniques that just link with one another, you know. And after a while, I stopped going after necks. I was like, I really like going after arms, and I can go from an Americana to a straight arm bar pretty quickly. I can go from that straight arm bar to a Kimura pretty quickly. Like, I started seeing these techniques. Do you have a favorite sequence or a favorite flow that the listener should maybe go home and practice?
I have things that I do, right? Like I would say that I don't have a preference, because my preference is submitting people.
Yeah.
And I don't care. I don't care how it happens. Right. You know, like the whole, like, you know, jiu-jitsu inside joke, you know, when you neck crack somebody, they're, oh, that was more of a crank than a choke.
It's still a submission.
Exactly. If I crank your neck far enough, you go unconscious.
Yeah.
So either way, it doesn't matter to me. Right. So yeah, like however it ends up happening, I've got a couple things that I do in the gym a lot that I haven't even had the opportunity to do in a fight. Mm-hmm. I do a a razor arm bar, probably be the best way to describe it. So it's like from your back, it's a face to, when you're face to face and you're hooking around the arm. Some people call it a straight arm bar, which really doesn't make any sense. So it's an arm lock from the bottom from in the guard, like with a high guard. And when they defend that, there's an elevator sweep off of that. And then I go through a series of that razor arm bar from a mounted position or goes into a Kimura. And I use that a lot. And I get it a lot in the gym, and you know, in grappling. When strikes are involved, I'm usually trying to land strikes more so that it opens up some bigger opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
So then that's mostly like I get into more like I don't know, singularly focused on like pouncing on those big moves, you know. I want back control. I want those spots where I can get higher percentage submissions.
You know, I watched one of your fights with Takanori Gomi.
Yeah.
And you had him in this ridiculous body triangle where I mean it was locked in. And I mean, he had two hands up protecting his face, and you're just cranking on him and cranking on him. And you know, when people think jujitsu, they think, okay, he's got his hooks in. It's like, okay, hooks are one thing. A body triangle, like the pressure from that alone can make you feel like breathing's uncomfortable, but now you're getting punched in the face, you know? Mm-hmm. There are so many fights where you've showcased that back take and then that control from the back where, you know, people will stand up and it's like, you're still on their back. You're the human backpack at that point. Is there one fight that really stands out where you're like, this was the best demonstration of me holding position, even if it wasn't like a submission showcase? It was like you controlled that position.
I think probably honestly when I fought Fabrizio Camoz, that was in 2013, right? Something like that. I don't know, 2013, 2014. I ended up armbarring him, and the entry was a little bit goofy, right? I was going for like a rubber guard esque, you know. It's like sometimes when you drill the moves a lot and you start learning them, they come out in the fight when they might not be ready for a fight, and it's kind of one of the issues I think we as fighters sometimes have. Is kind of going to something that's been drilled a bunch, but isn't game day ready. Mm-hmm. So and rubber guard was always one of those things. It's not my strength, but I was doing it a lot in training. And I went into a rubber guard entry and he tried to hit me. And right off of that, like him opening his hips up, I swung for this arm bar. And Fabrizio was a third degree black belt under, I think, Hoist at the time. And I remember locking up that arm bar, and I knew that there was no way for him to get out. Mm-hmm. Because of the way that I was able to enter into it very deeply. And one of the things that people often forget when they're trying to arm bar somebody is that we don't want, like, if I'm attacking the right arm, I don't want their right arm on the right side of their body. If I can pull that right arm across their chest to the left side of their body by having a good bite with my like hamstrings and pulling them down into it, everything gets tighter, right? So the way the shoulder moves and the way that the you know, you're going to get out of that arm bar and like shrink your arm out or hitchhiker out and all the escapes that you can do are way easier to do when your arm is on the correct side of your body. Once you pull it over to the opposite side of the body, everything tightens up and the shoulder doesn't move like it's normally does. So I was able to secure his, I think I got his right arm. I had his right arm pulled across. I was pulling his left shoulder down into almost into his bicep on his right arm. And then hooked the leg. And it was like, if he tried to stack me and put his weight on me, I was going to elevate his leg and roll him over. If he tried to pull out, I was going to be able to take it. So I remember that position, like I've never had somebody so dead to rights in a position. Like it was like, yeah, you're just waiting for the end at this point, you know, like, so it was that spot was probably like technically like the best thing I've ever done inside the octagon.
That's awesome. I'm gonna have to rewatch that fight. You know, my buddy, I mentioned his name before, Chris Smith, he always talks about in jiu-jitsu many times, your goal is to get someone into like the Major League Baseball rundown, you know, caught between mm-hmm. first and second, you know, you're going to get tagged out. You decide where you're going to get tagged out. Or he likes describing it as that movie Blood Diamond, when that invading force goes into the village and they're like, do you want short sleeve or long sleeve? Like, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Like it's going to be one or the other. It's going to suck either yeah. way. You just have to choose yeah. which one you want. You know, was that your proudest moment? Like, was there a fight where you're like, damn, this is it? Like looking back on your career, I mean, how many fights, over 50 fights, like, was that the proudest moment you've ever had?
I don't know. You know, I think, I mean, I think fighting on the cards, you know, with my brother in the UFC. I mean, we fought on the same card in the, you know, local circuit a few times. And then we fought UFC 124. We were the first siblings to both win.
No kidding.
On a UFC card. Because it's always, you know, it just adds this extra level of stress. So, believe it or not, right? You know, and it's not an easy thing to do. So we were the first ones to win on the same card, and that was pretty awesome. And then of course they're like, hey, let's do it again. So they put us on 128 together, and that went from like probably my proudest, like sharing, you know, sharing a victory with my brother, you know, on a UFC card, to my most difficult fight that I've ever had. And it wasn't because of my opponent. It was because of, you know, sharing the card with my brother. Mm-hmm. We were actually fighting back to back on a UFC main card, which was absolutely insane. There were some other issues surrounding, you know, like personal issues surrounding my brother that night. So I had to watch my brother fight with a broken heart, and then go out and fight myself, you know, against the guy that was undefeated and a tough matchup for me. So, that was a tough one. I'd say getting the win, you know, on the same card as Dan was pretty awesome.
Yes, definitely, for sure, for that one. You know, when you look at your career, there are so many stats that are involved, and the UFC, like any sport, it's very numbers based, right? Like, you know, how many wins, how many losses, how many by decision, and so forth and so forth. But then there are like the unofficial stats, like the qualitative ones. Okay. So I'm going to ask you a handful of questions I'm just curious about.
Sure.
In your opinion, or I should say, who cleaned your clock with a strike where you're like, that dude hits harder than anyone else? Like, if you have the most respect for someone's hands or their feet, was there one hit that you took, you were like, damn, that dude's good?
I've been knocked out twice. Mm-hmm. Donald Cerrone knocked me out in 2014, and he set me up, and I knew he was going to kick me in the head. In the very first exchange of the fight, he hit me with a knee that bruised my spleen.
Ooh.
So then every shot he landed after that, I had already, like, my body was already hurt, and he knocked the wind out of me. And I just felt my hands just going from my face down to my stomach every time. And, I was like, man, he's going to kick me in the head. And sure enough, he did. Dan Hooker ended up, he kneed me, in our fight in 2018, after I suffered a pretty good eye poke. So I didn't see that one coming. It was a hard enough shot that it, gave me a concussion and all this stuff, knocked me out. But I don't remember what it felt like.
Jesus.
But I have to say, like, the hardest shot that I remember taking and being like, oh, man, was Anthony Pettis. He hit me with an overhand right, and I was able to, be in a protected position. I think one of the things that I really, I preach to my guys and I live by it is that, we're not going to be able to avoid every shot. So I'd rather be in a position to a better position to absorb it. A lot of times when you are trying to slip punches and your head comes out of position, the neck is actually one of the biggest things in your ability to absorb a punch. It's kind of like your bungee, if you're bungee jumping, right? Mm-hmm. That's how you absorb it. So if your neck is stretched out already, then that bungee's already stretched out. If you load it, it might snap. So I was able to be kind of like loaded into it and almost coming into the shot when Anthony hit me with that right. And I remember it hitting me and it was like, whoa.
Yeah.
That was hard. Like, man, it's a good thing that was like hit me on the forehead, not someplace a little more vulnerable.
Man, when you look at strikers, like guys that pride themselves as strikers, their wrists are just formed differently than most human beings. Like, you can look at a puncher and know, like, okay, that guy punches a lot, because mm-hmm. it's like their fist is an extension of their wrist and there's no taper from their fist to like their forearm. And you're damn, that dude's gonna hit hard. You know what I mean? Like, it's just interesting that some people's bodies are just meant for attacking certain ways, man. And mm-hmm. I was just curious who it was. And I got to look back at that fight too. But now, is there anyone that you're watching as, like you said, you feel like you're in the twilight of your career. Is there anyone that you're watching as an up and comer who you're like, this kid needs more spotlight, or man, this kid's going to be amazing in this number of years? Like, is there anyone that you want to make a prediction on?
Not really. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I think that I'm trying to think in my weight class. I think a majority of the guys they're getting the spotlight that they deserve. You know, it's hard to, especially making those types of predictions, because it's not just the fights, right? Like, it's not just the fights, it's not just the training. There's also a life, you mm-hmm. know. There's also a life that things as fans we don't see that are going to affect those outcomes and those performances. So, I wish it wasn't that way, but it is, you know. And it's like that with any other profession, honestly. There are always going to be things that can affect your work life, you know.
Certain, yeah.
So. I have a tough time, I think, making that type of prediction, because it's I don't know what's going on in somebody's personal life.
Gotcha. So let's talk about your personal life now, because we've talked about the fight life. I mean, you're an outdoorsman. You know, we bonded over that when we were at Josh's place. We talked about hunting and fishing and all that great stuff. You mentioned New Jersey and Appalachia. You know, I'm mm-hmm. not a mid-Atlantic kid, but I'm a New England kid. So I've spent mm-hmm. a lot of time down in that area. What do you feel like is your greatest passion in the outdoors? Is it bow hunting? Is it trout fishing? What's your go-to?
Probably hunting, and honestly, like, so, I mean, my brothers and I, every summer we would make stick bows with some mason line mm-hmm. and we would basically just like bend a sapling, make a little stick bow, and they only last for like a few days. Right. And we'd steal my dad's cedar shaft arrows, and if he had some aluminum, we'd take those because they lasted a lot longer. and we would go and like stump shoot and you know, just live it up, you know, in the woods surrounding our house. And like I always enjoyed archery and shooting, but then like my biggest issue that I always had with it is I have a difficult time sitting still, believe it or not. Right? Like, so when I started hunting, like I got my license, I was like mid teens, because my dad, he grew up hunting, running beagles and English pointers, doing field trials and stuff like that. And they, whitetail season was very different when my dad was a kid in New Jersey. It was like 6 days, $1, and that was it. You know, nowadays I can hunt and I could shoot unlimited doe from mid-September through February, which is nutty, but that's the way the population is. So we grew up listening to all the stories from him, and when our grandfather, who ended up, my dad's side of the family moved out to Bozeman in 1980. So my grandfather would tell us all the stories and stuff like that. And like my brothers and I, we just wanted to do it. So my dad worked 6 days a week, you know, and any of his free time he spent coaching us in the football, baseball, wrestling. Like, so he didn't have the time to bring us out. There was no Sunday hunting. So it was something that my brothers and I had to do on our own, which I'm kind of glad that it worked that way. Because it meant that we, you know, like we were kind of committed to the process of getting our licenses, and it wasn't something that was forced on us. Yeah, so I was mid-teens when I finally got my license, and like I said, I had a tough time sitting still. So once I got my bow license and I had this bow that was probably older than I was at the time. So it was a Browning, you know, just wheeled compound bow, squeaky as hell. It made so much noise. I ended up shooting a doe with it. I think the first year we hunted with it, I found the stupid young doe, and I missed her the first time, and then I ended up getting her the second. But it was hard for me to sit in the tree stand. So I've had a lot more success hunting from the ground with muzzleloader, and still hunting and you know, finding those thick spots where I might not have really any shot with a bow, but with the muzzleloader, yeah, you know, I'd get those opportunities. So, but yeah, like any excuse that I could have to be out in the woods, whether it's like bushcraft type stuff or hunting or fishing, I'm out there. But hunting is definitely, it's not really a pastime. It's more of a kind of a way of life.
Yeah.
You know, it's part of my lifestyle. Growing up, we fished all the time, you know, for bass and stuff like that. So it wasn't necessarily things that we were eating. And unfortunately, there aren't too many fisheries around me that have fish that you can eat. That's the bad part about New Jersey. One of the bad parts about New Jersey. Yeah, like fishing at this point, unfortunately, it's more of a pastime. It's more something that I do with my kids, and you know, we get to go out and I just bait hooks and all that stuff. But yeah, hunting is more of a part of my life, you know, because we eat it so much.
And speaking of eating and part of being your life, I mean, is that what led to the cookbook? Because I had no freaking idea that you had a cookbook until we started talking. And I was like, what? And my publisher for my book is a publisher that makes a lot of cookbooks, and they probably would turn their nose to the idea of a wild game cookbook because, you know, they're a little bit more left-leaning than, you know, I want to admit. But but how did you come up with all these recipes? Were they family recipes? Were they recipes that you learned from friends, or what's the story with that?
Some of them are family recipes. you know, and a lot of the other ones, it's like, man, it's like here I have this resource, right? I'm going out and I'm getting pounds of meat, you know, every time I shoot an animal. And like as a kid, and it might be partly because my palate has changed,
mm-hmm.
or it might be that my dad wasn't as good of a cook, you know, when I was a kid, as he became,
yeah.
right? And you know, and my mom maybe they didn't really know how to use venison the way that I do now. I think field care, I think, is definitely something that that has changed, right? Mm-hmm. That's one of my biggest things that I found, like social media. There's a love-hate relationship with it. I think it's a time suck, and there's definitely negative aspects to it. But I've learned so much about like hunting and particularly field care from it. You know, so now my process is a lot different than like when I was younger. The first couple of deer that I shot, I mean, we used to split the hip and, you know, and the rib cage to get everything out. And then it's like you're dragging it out of the woods and it's like flopping over and you're filling it with dirt and leaves and like all this debris. And it's all like water soluble flavors that you're getting into this deer meat. And it's like, son of a bitch, like we were making so many mistakes. And it's like my dad would make venison and I'd be like, yeah, it doesn't really, I'm not a huge fan of it. And nowadays I make it and it's like my whole family loves it. And, you know, so a lot of the recipes, it was like, okay, how am I going to take this resource and, you know, not just do steaks, not just do backstraps. Like I've got all this other meat. So how are we going to do it? And I'm a big fan of different, you know, ethnic foods. And so like trying to take it and like, okay, hey, let's make a, you know, how many different types of, you know, like different types of tacos are we going to make with, you know, venison or black bear or this or that. So yeah, just trying to adapt, you know, those recipes. And honestly, if the meat is cared for properly coming out of the woods, it doesn't take any, you could sub, you know, you could sub wild game in for the beef, pork, chickens, you know, absolutely 100% of the time, you know, there's just going to be that slight difference in flavor. But, yeah, it all just came from trying to eat it make it as good as I can.
You know, I was never one to split the pelvic bone. I've always, yep. you know, tied off the butthole and, you know, pulled yep. it up through and ripped it out and left the gut pile there. My buddy, Mike O'Brien, who is a Utah guy, he's a huge, you know, wild game chef too. So I got to mention yep. that you got a cookbook and I'm sure he'll pick it up. But he's one who taught me about, you know, splitting the rib cage and cutting up through like mm-hmm. the connective tissue. And that's the easiest way to get the windpipe out. You know, instead of reaching up there, which I know a lot of people don't like doing, it's like the easiest solution, just pull it up through. But what is your method then? Like, cause now, like I'm hanging on that statement when you're saying like, uh-huh. I don't like dragging the deer through the woods with the open cavity. What's your yeah. go-to then? Because I know this fall I'll be back up in Connecticut on my old hunting grounds and I'm hopefully mm-hmm. going to take another doe or a buck up there. So just curious what your method is.
I try to, keep the incision as small as possible. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I was a kid, you know, or younger, you know, teenager and stuff like that. Like I've always been a knife guy. And I always liked big knives.
Hell yeah. So, hell yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, who doesn't, right? You know, so I was probably always carrying a knife that was a little too big. And, like I've got one of those, the scalpel style knives. I'm not a big fan of it. Because of the way the little guard on the blade, I think that I should be cutting and I'm not, and every time I use it, I cut myself. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I forget what year it was. It was probably about a decade ago. I went out with the muzzleloader one day. It's like late November. We always get like 2 days. And I wasn't really expecting to shoot anything. You know, I'd get like a deer, maybe two a year. And I went out and I shot the six pointer, and I was carrying an SE5 with me.
Oh my God, that's the thickest one.
Yeah, like this is a giant piece of sharpened steel. Because I was just like, I'll grab this one. And here I am gutting this thing. And of course, what ended up happening too is I shot this thing at like 15 yards. I was in this patch of laurels, mountain laurels, like no shots. I mean, and the most I probably could have shot was just under 20 yards. But I've shot a bunch of bucks in the same spot from like almost arm's length away. Mm-hmm. And so I shoot this thing, and of course, like, I'm super close, so I hit a little bit off of, you know, where my sights are. So I hit it a little high, ended up tearing the esophagus, but above the diaphragm. So like the cloud of smoke goes, right? And I see this thing, and it's hunched up like it's gut shot. And I'm like, there's no way I can gut shot this thing. So like I'm going through the process of like, all right, do I reload and put another one in it? Do I try to, you know, go and do the gory thing and slit its throat? And you know, it ends up expiring pretty quickly because I did get some major blood vessels and stuff like that. But so then I'm gutting this thing with this giant knife, and I was like, this is silly. Like, why am I doing this? So I made a shift towards carrying a better knife for the job. Because every time I'd go out, it wasn't only to hunt. It was also to like to practice some woodcraft if I had the opportunity, or if I, you know, if I just felt like it or whatever. So then I started carrying smaller knives, and now I use either the Montana Knife Company Blackfoot or the Speed Goat for most of them. What's the other one? I always forget the name. Oh crap.
You're talking about the one that looks like a Green River Skinner, like the big butcher.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. I can't think of the name. It's like Mountain something, I think. I don't know.
Yeah.
But,
Stonewall.
Yeah. I knew there was Mountain or Rock or something.
Yeah. That's probably my favorite, cause it's almost like a Nessmuk, but it's got a workable point, you know? I love that knife as well, but I find that for the deer around here, sometimes it's a little bit too big. So if I have got the right size knife, which like I said, is usually the Blackfoot or the Speed Goat, it's a lot easier to get up into the chest cavity to cut the esophagus, and then to cut around the entrails in the pelvis. And yeah, I'll usually pull the large intestine out, the, you know, tie it off if I have some string or whatever, or kind of like a tube of toothpaste, empty it out and then just pop it out.
Mm-hmm.
But I found that, yeah, keeping the opening that I cut as small as possible just reduces the amount of debris that I get in there. And then like now it, you know, now I've got a barn, I've got my hoist up in the barn. So, and a lot of the deer aren't making it very far off of my property. So, you know, I'll bring the tractor up and then I'm not even dragging them. So, and then I get to rinse them out and all that stuff. So yeah, I think that minimizing the amount of dirt that you can get on it, has really increase the quality of the venison that I get, you know.
Do you like to hang and age it, or do you like to butcher it right away?
I usually hang for about a couple days, you know. Like I had a few this last year that kind of pushed a week because of the weather. But it all depends on what I've got, you know, to process, if I've got any other ones to process, or depending on the temperature as well, you know. Like I do prefer that it get kind of cold. I'm not trying to hang anything if it's, you know, earlier season.
Yeah, man. Well, I'm telling you, just talking about hunting is like getting me ready for like the fall. Yep. Like I know that we're still a couple months away from the season, but this type of thing just fires me up. We could talk all day about this, but we've already been going a little bit for a while, and I'm sure we could always do a part two just talking about hunting and other fun things like taking down Hank. But what do you have any fights coming up, and where can people find your book, and how can people, you know, follow along and all your exploits?
I attempt to get onto like Facebook, and I really don't go onto Twitter all that much, but a majority of what I post is on Instagram. Instagram, Jim Miller _155, because they make it a pain in the butt when you're verified to change your name. So I haven't changed it to Jim A10 Miller like I've been wanting to. That's where I put most of my stuff. There is a link to the cookbook there. It's on Amazon, the Fighter's Cookbook. We ended up branding it as, wild game recipes. There are recipes that don't have wild game in it. And every recipe in there can be adapted for, the basics, you know, the beef, pork, chicken. On fights, I don't have anything scheduled at the moment. I asked to fight in November. There is a card, at MSG in November, so that's probably where I'll end up getting put, since I'm a local guy. So hopefully November time. Unfortunately, that means I'm gonna miss the rut.
Damn.
But I've got an elk and mule deer hunt at the end of the month here, so I'm pretty jazzed about that. Get to go up to Canada, hopefully, yeah, get another fight in by the end of the year, get a couple more in, and finish up this career. So
very nice, man. Well, I wish there was a very buzzworthy way or a viral worthy way of ending the podcast, like Derek Lewis, like just saying like my balls were hot, you know, that type of thing. but there's really no fun way of signing off. So I'll just thank you for coming on, and I appreciate to all you guys that were listening. So, thanks so much. This has been Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. I've been your host, Kevin Estella, with Jim A10 Miller.